we've got the papers coming up on Thursday and Friday. Tomorrow, we've got Nietzsche, John Richardson, Nietzsche on the Past, which would be terrific. Richardson's really one of the best Nietzsche people around. Written really two excellent books on Nietzsche. And then on Friday, unusually for a Friday, Christina Lafont is coming from Northwestern. She's written terrific books on Heidegger and Habermas. And is talking about Habermas on religion, which should be kind of interesting to see her reading of what a liberal needs to say about religion. So it should be intriguing for both, and I encourage you all to come. It should be really interesting occasions, both the latter, the first time the Graduate Faculty Journal is sponsoring the talk, doing that. So a solidarity for your own journal. Since the Graduate Faculty Journal is just done by the graduate students. Okay, so what I want to do today is finish off the deduction and do the schematism. Next week we will, so the strategy then will be to do 2 weeks on the analogies and the refutation of idealism. And then the final week, I guess, we'll work on the third antinomy. Seems appropriate. And I will frame next week by a kind of almost relaunching of the entire project. That is, I'll begin my lecture next week by really trying to show how you go via the analogies, the refutation, the problem of freedom into German idealism and beyond. So in a way, we can almost restart the whole course next week. Okay. So as I remember, I was reading paragraph 20 when the bell rang. Is that what happened? Something like that. So let's go back to paragraph 20. My reading, again, just to remind you before we get there, that paragraph 19 for me was a reworking in a way of the insertion of the argument of the metaphysical deduction into the transcendental deduction, so that the notion became one of realizing that the categories are the very functions for judging, and that they play the role they do by determining the representational content of a cognition, namely its form, and that there thereby is such a thing as an essential structure or a general form to judgment. And hence, just to set up the equation, the thought is making a judgment is going to be equal to the application of a category, which itself is going to be equal to spontaneously grasping an intuitive manifold presentation. Of an offer. That's all, and the important, what I'm trying to claim here is there's just one act. Right? There's just the act of judging. And the act of judging just is the application of a category, because categories are things that structure via the logical functions of judgment. They involve the application of categories, and the application of categories just is the spontaneously grasping the manifold in intuition as the presentation of an object. And this is to say that not the case that every time we say S is P, we are using the categories. That's plainly false. It is to say that every time we grasp something as a substance with a property, for example, it's tied up with the subject predicate form of judgment. So it's the other way around. Every use of the logical functions in order to grasp the manifold in an intuition involves the presentation of states of affairs, is hence involves an application of categories. So, as I said in the help session last week, you should think of the logical functions of judgment as like the rules of chess. They tell you nothing about any game of chess. Nothing. They are pure form, and every game is totally contingent, right? But nonetheless, you couldn't get started with a game of chess without those rules. Namely, you've got to move the pieces this way and that way, and the idea is to, I don't know, get rid of the other big pieces, right? Not very good at chess. Get the queen, get the king, whatever it is. We never play games in my household. So judgment is important. Not because all cognition is judgment, although that's true. Judgment is important because all cognition involves both receptivity and spontaneity. And spontaneity can only be objective if it is grounded in the essential structures of judgment. That's the thought. That's the crucial piece of the puzzle. And that should, all by itself, bring us to paragraph 20. So let me try that again. The manifold, the paragraph 20 is just a summary of the argument, and it looks like it's also the completion of the argument, and you'll have to explain in what sense it's not. The manifold given in a sensible intuition is necessarily subject to the original unity of apperception, because in no other way is the unity of intuition possible. Notice it's the unity of intuition that's there. Why is that important? Why is it not unity of sense data? Well, it should be old hands by now.
It's not it.
Intuition is a representation. So it's the crucial point is the reason why it's got to be, right? Grasp via the original synthetic unity of apperception is because it's a unity of intuition that we're trying to make possible, namely the unity of a representing. And the unity of a representing is only possible by, right, something holding together, the various parts hanging together. That's the notion of representational unity. But the act of understanding, sentence two, by which the manifold of given representations, be they intuitions or concepts, is brought under one apperception, is the logical function of judgment. So the kind of unity, the kind of hanging together that is cognitively significant for us human beings, is judgmental unity. That's what counts as unified. Subject is predicate, right? That's the kind of unity that is at stake. And step three, all the manifold, therefore, so far as it is given in a single empirical intuition, is determined in respect of one of the logical functions of judgment, and is thereby brought into one consciousness. So, given the story about judgment, and one of the logical functions of judgment must be operative in any judgment. Now, the categories are just these functions of judgment insofar as they are employed in determination of the manifold of a given intuition. That's the movement from this to this. That is, from logical function of judgments to categories. Right? Which is, again, the metaphysical deduction. Right? That, again, the categories are what's called the sensible material counterparts of the logical function of judgment. Consequently, the manifold in a given intuition is necessarily subject to categories. That's it. You don't need nothing else. Hope?
This may be a really simple question, but what is the difference between the logical function of judgment and unity of perception? So I thought that the unity of perception functioned toward that unity. So if it's the logical function of judgment, how is that not the unity of perception?
The unity of apperception is accomplished via the logical functions of judgment. That is, how does my mind sweep them all up? It gathers it together by judging. So the notion of unity that I need, the notion of synthesis, so transmitting that perception equals synthesis of manifold, right? Synthesis of manifold is making a judgment. So no. It's absolutely right to get that absolutely clear. And my claim has been, and let's just step one step back, the I think, so the I think becomes making a judgment, And my thought has been all along that making a judgment is something that is done always by an individual from a point of view. So that my judgment, this is a cup, that's the great objectification, right? It's a cup. Well, it's sort of a cup, whatever it is. But what is it? Is that called a cup? Anyway, it's a something. But as a judgment, although that objectivates it in space and time as independent from my subjectivity, right? Remember, that's what he said about the kapla is, right? It says, in saying the cup is round, I am making a claim about the object that is true irrespective of the state of my subjectivity. That's what the kapla means. On the other hand, only I can do that. So it's my judgment from a point of view, right? And that's Kant's way of claiming that, and this is the fullest burgeoning of, let's call it the Cartesian cogito, that the heart of subjectivity, the subjectivity of the subject, the I think, is itself an objectivity that generates worldhood. Right? That's the great moment of modern philosophy. This is why, in their different ways, even Heidegger and Merleau-Ponty are fully moderns, because they're trying to find in the very core of subjectivity an objectivity, an exteriority. So at the very place where I look to abstract myself most completely from the world, my spontaneity, that's the very thing that reaches out and gives me a world in general. And that's just what Descartes wanted, right? That's why Descartes thought the cogito ergo sum ended skepticism and introduced certainty, right? That was what Descartes meant by suddenly finding at the very point where the evil demon was reaching into his soul, and he says, no, no, I exist anyway, you son of a bitch. Right? Which, I won't go through it, but it's actually an argument against faith in Descartes, which is why we know that Descartes was an atheist. Of course. Well, the evil demon doubt, think about it, must be an argument about the relation between faith and reason. And it must be an argument concerning why the very idea of faith is a repudiation of self, and therefore the affirmation of the cogito is an affirmation of the self against any conceivable deity. And that's got to be what that's about. Anyway, but I'm not going to talk about that. Okay, so what Kant is trying to do is carry out that Cartesian project where you find the resources just here, right, for objectivity. So the question now is, are there any further questions about where we are now? So we'll kind of gather it up in a kind of transcendental synthesis.
But it's about the relation between synthesis and analysis. Mm-hmm. Now, about B130, so just a few pages before I'm going to go into Kant ends up saying something to the effect that analysis and synthesis seem to be oppositions, mm-hmm. but nevertheless, analysis is presupposed mm-hmm. by synthesis. Or rather,
sorry, other way around.
Other way around, right? So synthesis is presupposed by any possibility right. of analysis. And we also said that the way that the transcendental deduction seems to be working is by way of the analytical force or thrust of the I think. And I'm just wondering whether or not that means that there's something prior to the analytical thrust of the I think that constitutes the I think.
You shall, what's the answer? This is your topic. I just embarrassed him like crazy. The quickie here is just like, so just remember the kind of motto. And you should never in doing philosophy be afraid of vulgarity. Vulgarities are the motor of clear thought. So at least my one motto that I've kept repeating is no unity without unification. Analytic unity is a form of unity, right? One thing is contained in another. And the Kantian dictum says nothing is going to count as analytically unified unless we have unified it. So every form of givenness in Kant turns into an activity. Right? This is, and you'll see the same motion in Hegel, right? Every form of givenness becomes something we do rather than something we suffer. So that's why. So he does want to do a form of analysis, but he wants to show that underlying what look like analytic truths, there's synthetic activity.
So it's not going to be the case that the I think is simultaneously cause and effect of some kind of other activity.
No. Spontaneity. It's a first. Yeah, Mike?
Yeah, I was wondering about for certain logical judgments that aren't in the categories like the hypothetical, disjunction, and it seems like conjunction is.
They are in the category.
Well, I thought he suggested that they aren't because they're relations between judgments, not. They're not the making of a judgment, but the relations between judgments.
Yeah, but he thinks that's absolutely right. He thinks that these logical functions are, now let's get absolutely clear, either judgments or the basic logical relations between judgments. So if then is for him an irreducible relation between judgments, if X is the case, judgment one, then Y is the case, judgment two.
So those wouldn't be outside spontaneity.
No, they are the exemplary forms of spontaneity.
Well, I mean, I just think in like conjunction, especially disjunction, this or that or that or that, seems like that would be like sequential and not spontaneous.
Now, spontaneity here is the case if the relationship. So, for example, the question about, of course, Kant didn't have modern symbolic logic, so he didn't have the law that, either X or Y, which would turn out to be true if either X is true or Y is true. But nonetheless, he thought that anything like that was exemplary of spontaneity and nothing else. And the proof of this is going to be Michaud's PhD. That's the aim to prove just that, isn't it? Yeah. So I understood last night. Yeah. Okay. He just gave a presentation last night. So that's the project anyway. That is to show, and think about this again, where we started. Let me just remember where we started. I said that Kant's starting point was that cognition is discursive. Discursivity is a matter of doing something with concepts, not mental vision. Right? So Kant doesn't think that having a truth is seeing, having a mental perception of a truth, it's making a judgment. and or following certain logical laws.
It's always a doing of something and of a connecting of concepts in particular ways. Well, the question, anything else? So the question now is, Kant seems to have said, the manifold, consequently, the manifold in the given intuition is necessarily subject to the categories. And that looks like QED for the whole deduction. What's missing? And needless to say, because this is Kant scholarship, there are, I would guess, I don't know how many different possibilities here, but I'm aware of, at least somewhere in the low teens of different interpretations. I will not trouble you with all the possibilities, because all the possibilities, bar the one that I'm going to give you, assume that something has been left unshown. So each of them has to say, oh no, Kant really hasn't shown everything yet. He hasn't, for example, shown, Allison thinks, that we have knowledge of objects in the weighty sense, that is external to us. Or, if it's Howell, he hasn't shown that it applies to human sensibility. Or if it's Dieter Henrich, he hasn't shown it applies to more than one given intuition that is unified by itself. All of which strike me as far-fetched. The right account, I think, is that paragraph 20 reaches an unrestricted conclusion about discursive cognition in general. That is, the manifold of a given intuition spans under categories. What then does paragraph 26 add, since that's the puzzle? What does paragraph 26 add that isn't there? What it adds is the claim that the spatio-temporal, and I'm going to go through all of paragraph 26, so don't worry about it. The spatiotemporal structure of all possible human cognition is a particular determination of the abstract determined structure that is common to all possible discursive cognition. So my claim is that paragraph 20, we reach an unrestricted conclusion, and what paragraph 26 simply adds is a further determination, that is, it's a movement from the abstract to the concrete. It's not a new or extra thought. It's not solving a new problem. It's rather making more precise, by making more concrete, what we already know. That is, it's already assumed that this holds. We're talking about intuition, so we're talking about sensible intuitions. Of course, that's the only kind that us human beings have. So we can be not talking about sensible intuitions. What we haven't done is said anything concrete about sensible intuitions, namely that they're spatiotemporal. So all this is a form of further determination, further concretion of the original argument. So what paragraph 26 is going to argue
And now, this is my summary of the first paragraph, and then we'll look at the first paragraph. But what it's going to argue, or what Kant says it's arguing, is that the spatio-temporal structure of experience is not independent of its category-determined structure, but is instead a particular determination of it, so the spatio-temporal structure of human experience is a particular determination of the category-determined structure of world cognition, and therefore, it follows, that's right, it follows automatically that we can know a priori a particular range of truths about space and time. So, he says, right, first sentence, the metaphysical deduction, the a priori origin of the categories has been proved through complete agreement with the general logical function of judgment. Step one, this is paragraph 26, right at the beginning. In the transcendental deduction, we have shown their possibility as a priori modes of knowledge of objects, of an intuition in general. Intuition in general. That's how far we've gone. Now he's saying we're going to make it more precise. We have now to explain the possibility of knowing a priori by means of categories, whatever objects may present themselves to our senses, not indeed in respect of the form of their intuition, but in respect of the laws of their combination, and so, as it were, of prescribing laws to nature, and of even making nature possible. For unless the categories discharge this function, so we're going to discover general laws about space and time, namely the kind of unity they must have, because if we did not, right, next sentence, for unless the categories discharge this function of making nature possible, unless they discharge this function, there could be no explaining why everything that can be presented to our senses must be subject to laws which have their origin a priori in the understanding. So, here's a little trick. How absolutely clear. How are the categories going to determine nature in general? How's that possible? Well, because the first action of the categories is going to be on space and time. That the categories are going to determine space and time, and indeed they can determine space and time because they're already a priori. They're our forms of intuition. Nothing can affect us except by being spatio and temporal. So we know anything that could appear must appear as in space, in time. But now we're going to show that the unity of space and time is not given, but is itself a product of the categories. So the categories, as it were, get at everything, the whole world, by determining space and time.
There's a line in here that says, not indeed in respect of the form of their intuition, which I would take the form of their intuition to be space and time. Is that wrong?
We'll come to that in the section. We have to distinguish between the form of intuition and formal intuition. Remember week two? I said there was a distinction between form of intuition and formal intuition. It's going to come back. This is why I keep telling you we've already got everything. You just have to wait for it to come back. So I'm going to come to that. It's the relationship between givenness and unification. So what's going to go on here is an account, an explanation of how our a priori knowledge of the category-determined structure of our experience. That's what we've got already. We know our experience now is, that's this argument. We know there's the a priori category structure, category-determined structure of our experience. We know that already. We're going to have to discover how that is at the same time. At the very same time, an a priori knowledge of the laws of combination of whatever objects may appear before our senses. So that is the ways in which objects can be related or combined in space and time. That's saying more than you're bargaining for. I can see it. I can see those ugly, skeptical looks. But it's just, I mean, after all, if space and time, again, just before I read this, the argument, I mean, this third paragraph is just one argument, each sentence of which is a step in the argument. Allison was right about that. Allison, the simple argument again is space and time are forms of sensibility. Nothing can appear that doesn't appear as at somewhere or some way. We've discovered that the categories structure our experience necessarily via the notion of judgment. And now what we're doing is simply taking that story about judgment and applying it to space and time, of which the consequence is the very notion of the unity of space and time. That is the nature of how things are related in space and time. That is, for Kant, the very idea of nature as a law-governed whole is determined by the a priori structures that determine categories. And so, first take a deep breath. See, I made you nervous. And I can see you thinking, am I going to have to understand this by understanding the next paragraph? And the answer is no, because what Kant's going to do, and I'll say more about this in the second half, is he's going to state this thesis in general, and then give it a little bit of wiggle, a twist, right? And he's going to call that the schematism. And that's his going to way of showing how the categories do it. As it were, he's going to go from a formal account of the determination to a more substantive account
And then in the analogies, it's as if he's going to start all over and show how you have three categories, namely substance or duration, succession, and community, I'll come back to that in a moment, that themselves structure time, temporal determination, and therefore structure the very idea of the unity of nature. So this question about the unity of nature being structured in categories is what we're doing for the next 3.5 weeks. Nothing else. Okay, so you don't have to get it all by getting the next paragraph. The transcendental deduction, as it were, promises more than it delivers. Lots of jokes about that, but I'm just repressing them like crazy. Okay. So you have the feel for this structure? Are you ready to take a deep breath and look at the argument? Okay. B160. Each sentence here, 5 sentences more or less, 5 steps in the argument. There's a fine account of this, repeats the analysis. But most everyone nowadays has got the feel for this argument. It's not sure how it's been figured out. In the representations of space and time, we have a priori forms of outer and inner sensible intuition. That's just the argument of the transcendental aesthetic. And to these, the synthesis of apprehension of the manifold of appearance must always conform, because in no other way can the synthesis take place at all. So, I can't so this is the way, this first sentence is the argument, space and time as a constraint upon the synthesis of the manifold. Right, this runs from space and time as pure forms of intuition to saying, hey, synthesis, if you're going to synthesize anything, you've got to synthesize through me, because only through me can anything be present to consciousness. Right? Time is even the form of inner sense, right? So nothing can be in consciousness or presented to consciousness that is not either somewhere or some way. And therefore, whatever spontaneity works on, it works on it via the forms of intuition, namely space and time. So that's the constraint on it. So it's got to, as it were, connect up with that. And now comes the turn. This one sentence is a rewriting of the entire transcendental aesthetic. So we spend 2 weeks on it, a waste of time. So we have to rewrite the whole damn thing. But space and time are represented a priori not merely as forms of intuition, that is, not merely as conditions of the possibility of receptivity, but as themselves intuition. One. So, in order for space to be a pure form of intuition, that in which
anything must appear, it must simultaneously be something that we actually intuit. So something that itself is an intuition, a one, and therefore in need of synthesis. So space and time are represented as not only as forms, but as themselves intuitions, which contain a manifold of their own. Space and time are complex ones. They have about them a manifoldness, and therefore are represented with the determination of the unity of this manifold. So, because space and time are intuitions, they are complex, and as complex, they have to be unified. And it's the unity of their manifold which is going to be the work of synthesis. And this is where he has the footnote that we already looked at when we did the Transcendental Aesthetic, where he says, space represented as an object contains more than the mere form of intuition, it also contains combination of the manifold. So the least, now let me clear again, the least awareness of space, say of a line, a point, is a synthesis of a manifold. Same with time. So it's not merely the form in which anything might appear, that's its, let's call it, it's in the mode of givenness, it's also something that requires. As complexity requires unification. And therefore we have the idea, he says, in an intuitive representation, so that the form of intuition gives only a manifold, the formal intuition gives unity of representation. And then here's the backtracking over the aesthetic, right? In the aesthetic, I have treated this unity as belonging merely to sensibility. That was the fudge. I treated this unity of the sensory manifold as belonging merely to sensibility, simply in order to emphasize that it precedes any concept. Although, as a matter of fact, it presupposes synthesis, which does not belong to the senses, but through which all concepts of space and time first become possible. So, in the aesthetic, he wanted to make sure that we got the intuitive aspect of space and time. Right? The ways in which space and time were irreducible to conceptuality. Hence I gave you the long story of even about left and right. Although it turns out you can have actually mathematical representations of left and right. But that irreducibility to conceptuality is an aspect. Not the total story. The total story says, in fact, any actual unity of a representation, right, presupposes synthesis and therefore conceptual determination. For since by its means, space and time are first given as intuitions, the unity of this a priori intuition belongs to space and time, and not to the concept of the understanding. So he's trying here to struggle with the thought of the relationship between givenness, and therefore the sensible, and its conceptual determination.
So the thought here is space and time are represented a priori not merely as forms of intuition, but as intuitions themselves, which therefore contain a manifold, and thus with the determination of the unity of this manifold in them. Therefore, he's going to go on to say, space and time are themselves grasped through category-determined synthesis. Next sentence. Thus, the unity of the synthesis of the manifold without that space or within us, that's time, and consequently also a combination to which everything that is to be represented as determined in space or in time must conform. And remember, everything that is to be represented as determined in space and time is everything. It doesn't leave anything out, is given a priori as the condition of the synthesis of all apprehension, not indeed in, but with these intuitions, so that nothing can even be apprehended. And remember, apprehension is the most minimal form of sensible awareness, right? Apprehension in intuition, reproduction in imagination, recognition in concept, apprehension in that notion of threefold synthesis is the minimal encounter with anything given. So even the minimal encounter with anything given is bound up with the laws of combination of synthesis. This synthetic unity, so the synthetic unity of even the most minimal apprehended whatever, this synthetic unity can be no other than the unity of the combination of the manifold of a given intuition in general in an original consciousness in accordance with the categories insofar as the combination is applied to our sensible intuition. So, that breathless sentence, what's happening there? This synthetic unity, unity of the apprehension, what is it? It's this. Is nothing other than the very same category determination that holds of intuition in general. Remember, paragraph 20 ended with intuition in general. So that notion of intuition in general now turns out to be even true of that which is apprehended, where apprehension is, right, the first moment of any possible spatial or temporal awareness. All synthesis, therefore, even that which renders perception possible, is subject to the categories. Right. So this structure, again, the end of paragraph 20 says, is subject to categories. Therefore, every synthesis is subject to categories, and since experience is knowledge by means of connected perceptions, just what knowledge is, the categories are the conditions of the possibility of experience, and are therefore valid. Notice the conclusion, a priori for all the objects of experience. So because, and this will come back over, this is kind of on the famous Hextra, the necessary conditions for the possibility of experience are at the same time the conditions for the possibility of the objects of experience. So that which structures my judgmental awareness of the world, because that's the operation of the categories on the intuitive manifold, and it turns out that the first, the a priori intuitive manifold, is the manifold of space and time, then by showing that anything that appears so that I must have a unification of them, well then it follows that the categories apply to anything that can appear in them. But since they are the conditions of anything appearing to me whatsoever, then the categories apply to anything that can appear. That's the transcendental introduction. I don't know if it was worth 10 weeks. Let's have a 7-minute break. Try to shake your head and think about that. And ask questions about it and see where we are.